Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with a tin can sailor from World War II, Stan Filgus, 93 years old, of Fresno, California, part of the original crew of the destroyer USS Wedderburn. The son of immigrants from what was known then as Czechoslovakia, Stanley was one of two brothers to serve in our armed forces during World War II. His older brother, Albert, served in the Army Air Corps, and after getting treated for a serious neck injury, Al was paraded around from one hospital to another playing ping pong to demonstrate that one could sufficiently recover from that kind of injury. Stan would suffer an injury aboard his ship, but not in the manner you would likely imagine. We'll get to that eventually, but let's talk about that brand new destroyer's first taste of combat. This is July 1944. Stan Filgus is 18 years old. The initial assault on Guam has just taken place, and the Wedderburn would spend the next 3 weeks there protecting the invasion forces.
Was it Guam? Yeah. I got there at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they had flares coming down on parachutes so that the lines at night would interchange, and I couldn't understand what that was until they said the lines probably stop and the fight starts in the dawn. That's how that worked out. Everybody had a little different idea of how it went. I did the best I could to make it work.
Well, and I know we'll hear some specific instances, but just tell me, generally speaking, when general quarter sounds, what do you have to do? And how long do you have to keep doing it?
I have to go to the gun and pick up my helmet and the radio part and stand by until they say fire. That gun had a tray, and you put the powder in first, 28 pounds, and then the projectile's 54 pounds, and he puts it in, and he rams the firing pin, and it shoots.
And what was your specific role on that gun crew?
At that time, I had to see that everything was what it should be. I was responsible to the other people that it is right, it will fire, and it's nice and oiled and all that stuff. I had to watch for that. I had a good crew.
And you mentioned, you know, putting on the headset so you had radio communication. What are you hearing there? What kind of communication is taking place?
Well, you tell them it's ready, you're ready, and all that. They said, stand by, and they wait for that fire signal.
And you've got other guys who are responsible for aiming it, raising it, lowering it, left to right?
The trainer and a pointer, and they manipulate their calculations to hit something.
So this is a lot of people working together. It takes teamwork, and you were in charge of that team on that gun?
Well, the teamwork, sure. Each gun was proud of it. How their gun looked. They were very well taken care of because our lives depend on it, and you don't want it not to work.
What was the most challenging thing for you on that ship with all the time you spent on her?
To have to deal with the movement of the ship. There was always a little bit of tension because you never know if it was a mine in the water or something like that. You get used to that, though. That way of life, that you've got a ship, that's your home, and you better do the best you can with it.
Well, I know there was plenty that you witnessed, whether it was stuff heading for your ship or what happened to ships around you. What are some of those things that you saw and experienced that underscored the stakes of this war?
The first thing we saw was that the Japanese were going to be a real, real tough fight.
And you knew lives would be lost, but most people I talk to never think it's going to be them. I understand, though, you had a situation when an ammunition ship exploded very close to you, and it sounds like that kind of underscored the gravity of the situation and the danger of this duty you were carrying out for our country.
By Ulithia, that would be there. I was going to church. I got off the boat and put my foot inside, and that thing exploded. They torpedoed it with a one-man torpedo thing, and it got in there, and it did get a hit. And I thought, wow, it was an ammunition ship that it hit, which was full of ambition. And it made a terrible sight. And like I said, the priest said, fellas, you know what happened right now? He says, be right. Take care of yourself, because things like that happen.
So he took that opportunity with this tragedy happening right next to you to say, hey, you could be gone tomorrow. Make sure what you're doing today is what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Be ready. That's kind of tough to listen to, but that was what he said.
And the fact that you're telling me that story kind of makes it sound like that made a strong impression on you.
It did. It sure did. And I had a couple of times where someone took our hit, took the one that could have got us, get them. You see one get blown up, they get you. I remember one of the ships ran into a mine at night, which they're floating, and wow. So even it's dark, those mines are floating around, and you say, geez, what if we hit one of those things? So there's always a chance that things aren't going to be perfect, and you have to try to make them perfect. And I ended up sleeping in my gun turret with a life jacket and a blanket, and I didn't have to keep running to the ship. I was there. Gun four is ready. Mandan's ready. And a gunnery guy said, fine. When that bell goes off, it's got the sound of its own. They can't copy that sound. You got a spine jiggles a little bit when that goner, you wonder what the hell's going to happen.
Had you seen other guys do that, or was that your own idea to sleep in the gun turret?
Well, that was my idea because my bunk was in the dining room, and I had a top bunk, and wiring was right above me. And I looked at that, and I looked at the hatches to go in and out and all that. I looked at that, and I said, I will get out of here. There's too many guys here, and they takes time to get through to go. So I thought, I'm going to go where I'm right there. I should be closer to that gun. It was a steel floor. I got by all right with it, but that was important to me, that to be in that gun, because they called general quarters quite often.
Were you concerned that you wouldn't be able to get out of where your bunk was if your ship were hit?
I thought I wouldn't get out of there. I said I didn't like that at all, that crampy everything with bunks that are hanging here and there. So I went in the gun and I stayed there.
I can't imagine that a 5-inch 38 gun turret is a very comfortable sleeping arrangement.
Well, in those days, it was just fine with me. It didn't bother me to sleep on the deck. That helped me be ready instantly instead of going through these doors to try to get there. The bakery was up ahead of us. When they baked, they would bring me some goodies.
The bakers would bring you goodies because they knew you were sleeping up there?
Well, yeah. When we manned the gun, I had the cooks and bakers, and they knew me from that. They're not baking when we're fighting. I got to know them pretty good.
So some of those cooks and bakers, when general quarters sounded, they would have a role on your gun crew?
Yeah.
Well, I know we're going to talk about kamikazes in 1945, but there's something else that happened before that, and your ship was one of many that were touched by this. In fact, there were three destroyers that sank in the famous Typhoon Cobra, or Halsey's Typhoon. Now, that would have been right after your 19th birthday, and this is another not-so-pleasant birthday present. What do you remember about that typhoon and how you guys experienced it aboard the Wedderburn?
Well, the sea got real rough, and the captain got on this communications, and he said, this destroyer is built to take a wave, a big wave turnover. Our captain did a good thing. We had our fuel tanks emptied to take fuel, and he re-ballasted that, which gave us the ability to maneuver. And those that did, the three that sunk, didn't re-ballast with salt water. They just took the ocean what it wanted. The best thing that happened to us was our captain re-ballast. and with the ship caught on a wind holding you way up there, that ballast would bring us down to where we could come back.
Tell me about how you experienced the typhoon. Where were you on the ship, and what did it do to you?
Well, the first place, we were down below decks because of the turmoil up above. It got very concerning to us. Is this thing going to turn off or turn over? And with that captain doing what he did, it really helped us a lot.
Were you holding on to something?
We were. Well, you could walk good. It was an uncomfortable, terrible typhoon. They lost 790 men in that one instant, which was a major, major setback.
Well, and I always wonder, when you're experiencing that, when you're below deck, you can't see what the water's doing, but you're feeling every move it makes, and you have no idea how long it's going to last. What do you do? Are you thinking about something? Are you imagining a better day or calmer seas? Are you saying a prayer? What are you doing?
Well, the thought was, how much can this thing take? And it turned out that it was done right by re-ballasting it.
And I don't know if this is a fair question or one that you can answer, but it just makes me wonder, on a fear scale, on a scariness scale, compared to having a kamikaze flying at you, which you did, or enemy artillery firing at you, which you did, where does that typhoon rank? Was it as scary as those other situations?
Yes, it was. A lot of doubt was there. We were hoping that they'd make the right decisions. So the typhoon was a tough situation. We lost a lot of men there.
Yes, nearly 800 American lives lost between those three capsized destroyers, the Hull, the Monahan, and the Spence. Dozens of other ships were damaged by Typhoon Cobra 75 years ago this December, the exact same time in which the Battle of the Bulge was unfolding in Europe. If you dig back in the archives at hometownheroesradio.com, look for an interview with Pat Doohan, who later on would become a friend, thanks to Honor Flight, of our guest today, Stan Filgus. Mr. Doohan was one of 62 sailors to escape from the destroyer USS Hull as it went under in that typhoon. As for that 18-year-old former high school football star and champion sprinter, Stan Filgus, he would have kamikazes to dodge as the war raged on. We'll hear what he has to say about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with Honor.